And then I ask, what do you remember from therapy? What was it that made a change? And then this boy said it was the orange ball. And I was confused. I thought, he's confusing me with another therapist. But then I remembered that in the beginning, when we were doing family therapy, in the last 10 minutes, we were playing soccer with an orange ball. And he was trying to score and against me. And of course, he did. And he said, I didn't want to go to you. I was very afraid. But because of this game with this orange ball, I started to like you. And I started to like to come to therapy. And without this ball, it would not have worked. You would not have succeeded. And often when I ask the question, what was it that made a difference, family members point at these small, playful differences. So I am always open and always curious about those small differences that makes a difference. So that's what I'm looking for when I work with feminists. And that's what I'm looking for when I do research with them about how can we make meaning together and how can we find something small that makes a difference.
Welcome to The Systemic Way. In today's episode, we have the wonderful pleasure of speaking with Robert Van Hennick. He's a systemic family therapist and a professional doctor in systemic practices from the Netherlands. In our conversation with Robert, we talk about his ideas on practice-based, evidence-based practice, which is an idea he's come up with in his thesis, and it's a way of navigating complexity in feedback-informed systemic therapy. It was a really enlightening and eye-opening discussion with Robert, who shares such wonderful examples of his work and really brings to life what I felt to be the embodiment of a systemic approach to psychotherapy alongside research. Judy, can I ask what might have stuck out for you?
Yeah, thanks, Cesar. I guess what stood out for me, well, there's many things. I think we get some really wonderful case examples of Robert bringing his thesis and his approach to life, which is always just such a privilege to hear, I think. And within that, it's hard to choose one thing to talk about, but I'm going to expose It's hard to choose one thing to talk about, but what I'd like to speak about is the collaborative approach to his work and how everybody has to get on board with the intervention that might be happening for a young person. And it's really interesting to hear how they do it, which is very systemic, but also at the same time feels quite radical in some ways. Is there anything else you want to add, Cesar?
Sure, it was such a rich conversation. I really, really loved his ideas of the systemic compass, which he talks about. What I understood to be a bit of a structure to a family therapy session or a piece of work with families, where he talks about motive. He talks about creating a collaborative shared narrative, thinking about goals and using feedback in a kind of a regular and systematic way. So I found it as a discussion that really pushed me along in my understanding of how to bring systemic ideas into the structure of a session, which I hope people find really useful. So, hope you enjoy.
Welcome, Robert Van Hennick, to The Systemic Way. It's really good to have you here with us. Do you want to maybe start telling us where you are? Where you're located, where we're meeting you today.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And I'm very happy to have this conversation with you. And I'm looking forward to what's unfolding in our conversation. Right now, you can see it, but the listener can't, of course. I'm sitting in my therapy practice. I work at Lawrence House. The Lawrence House is a center for systemic family and couple therapy in the Netherlands, in Haarlem, quite close to Amsterdam. And this is my therapy practice. So I see families here, parents with children. I see couples here. I sometimes work with groups. And we also teach, we also give training to students in systemic practices, therapy, but sometimes also consultation. So this is the place where I work. And the Lawrence House in the Netherlands is quite famous. It is a very innovative center. They develop new programs and new ways of thinking about systemic practices here in the Netherlands. So it is a well-known institute, and I'm proud to work here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How incredible to, because I suppose, I think, like in my setting, I'm assuming that everybody in your setting then is family therapists, systemic therapists.
Yes, so there are everybody is systemically trained. Yeah, that's what we share together. And of course, some people are psychiatrists, some people are originally social workers, some people are psychologists. But all the people who work here has a training in systemic therapy, because this is for us also a way of looking to the world, and it has also to do with relational ethics. I think it's a way of, I think that all the people who work here really believe that if we work with one person, or if one person is changing a little bit, it has an effect on all the other important people. I sometimes compare it with what's the word in English? What's floating on the water? A raft or something.
Yes.
You have eight people on a raft, and one of the persons is moving or changing his or her position. Then it has an effect on everybody. And there's a risk that the raft will turn over and everybody falls in the water. So, or somebody has to go back to the original place, or everybody has to move a little bit. And that's, I believe, what is important in systemic thinking and systemic therapy, that we always realize that an individual's change has an effect on all the other people who are concerned or who are involved. So this is something we share together. And everybody who works here, we also have intervention groups, and we all also organize meetings this is what we want to learn about and what we will tell about when we work with people. Yeah.
Thank you. And I suppose we should say that today,
yeah,
we are going to be talking to you about, I struggle to keep this in my head, but I'm going to give it a go. Cesar, you might have to jump in. We're talking about practice-based, evidence-based research.
Yeah,
all right. Wait, tell me.
I've trained it a lot. It is practice-based, evidence-based practice.
For some reason I've put an R in, and that's where I got lost. But research is part of it.
Yes, we practiced this before you joined us, Robert.
We did.
Yeah, it's practice-based, evidence-based practice. And it is a little bit a language game. I'm playing the game. I can tell a little bit more about it, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please do. Please tell us.
Now,
maybe what the term is and how you, how you kind of coined that term as well.
It was, I worked before at a center in the Netherlands. It's called the Viersprong, and we did we worked with multifamily therapy. So we worked with family groups. We worked with four or five families at the same time. And I have a very, very good experience with this. I really believe that this is a very good way of working with families. So we work with the inner circle and an outer circle, and sometimes all the fathers were in the inner circle and they were talking about something that was difficult for them, and they went back to the outer circle, and then the mothers came in, or children came in, or other people came in, and then had a conversation about what just was talked about by, for example, the fathers or the children, or sometimes the therapist went in a circle, or one of the families, and we had this inner circle and outer circle, and then we worked with outsider witness reflections based on the work of Michael White, and then we had a break, and after that we went to the gym where people can do sports, and we did nonverbal exercises with the families, and this was very successful, and we were very proud on it, and a lot of our colleagues came and to see what we were doing over there, and there was one day that the manager or one of the managers of the institute came to me and my colleague and said, well, we think you do an amazing job, but we are in a center for evidence-based practices, so it's important that you make a decision. You have to choose and choose a model, and so we could choose between EFFT, ABFT, AFFT, MST, FFT, SFFT, MDFT. Well, everything I said is really existing, and there's much yes. more in this. But yes. we had the idea that they wanted us to choose for letters with dots in between. And we didn't want to do it because we really had the feeling that if we choose for one model that we lose more than we would gain, and we have learned so much from different inspirations and different sources within the systemic family, within the world of systemic family therapy, that we couldn't make, we didn't want to make this choice, because we also really believed and experienced that what works in one family does not work in another family. And sometimes when I ask families, what made the difference? What made the difference that matters? Then family members say sometimes point to very small things, very small tipping points. And so we really believe that you cannot standardize systemic therapy. I like the quote from Tom Anderson a lot, who says that change evolves spontaneously, and we never know what it is, how it will happen, and when it will happen. So we have to improvise. We have to improvise in therapy and find ways to go on every time in a new way. So we call it situated knowledge. Yeah? And because this was what was important for us, and this was what we experienced as helpful in the therapy that we gave or that we provided. So we had a difficulty with this question, to make a decision to choose an evidence-based model. So in the beginning we played a little bit the language game. I liked the phrase of Lynn Hoffman a lot, who talks about poetic disobedience. So that we thought, if they want letters with dots in between, they can have it. So in the beginning we talked about FITS, feedback informed therapy within systems. So we thought we don't choose a model or a method, but we ask feedback all the time, and we really believe that we make decisions about how do we collaborate in a better way together. We make the decisions about that based on the feedback we can get back from the family members. So we talked about FITS, and of course FITS, feedback informed therapy, is created by Scott Miller. So we used his inspiration and his client directed outcome interviews, but we wanted to make it more systemic. So we did not only evaluate the relationship between the client and the therapist, but we wanted to evaluate all the relationships in the system, in the family system. So the question all the time was, how can we as a team become more effective? How can we collaborate in such a way that we can improve or learn according to your goals or according to your values? So that was what we and we named it FITS. But this FITS was really a language game. It did not exist. It was a way that allowed us to do what we were already doing, and that was a fun thing. But it worked. So the institutes really chose to make a folder out of it, and it was a product. So systemic therapy with all the history was not evidence based enough, and when we invented something ourselves, it was okay. It was like a benchmark or something. I don't know, but in the beginning we had a laugh about it, but later I started to take it more seriously, and I started, and that is the beginning of my question or my desire to do research about our work. I was really curious, can we find a scientific understanding about improvisation, coordinated improvisation in systemic family therapy? So in the beginning it was a little bit a game, a language game, and later it became more serious, and I really wanted to look for a way of doing research, well, practice-based research about improvisation in therapy. And then these words, practice-based, evidence-based practice, again, it is poetic disobedience. It is a little bit of a language game. It is practice-based evidence. So it's evidence based on practice. So it's always situated. But it's important that the research is informing the practice. So it's practice-based evidence-based practice. Because sometimes what I experienced, a lot of research is done and there we write beautiful articles about it and it disappears in the, well, in the literature or in the university. But how does our research really inform our practice? That was important for me. So my last thing about this is we practice-based, evidence-based practice means that I do research not about family members, but with them. It's collaborative research. And the output of the research is the input for the therapy. So it becomes like a loop, like a circle.
I know. And I think, Robert, that was the thing that when I was doing the reading that really changed my mindset about research was about doing it with the people, the families that you work with. And there was something about the, I think you spoke a little bit to the collaborative aspect of that, but the ethical stance of it, I think, was so appealing to me. And I was just wondering in terms of a question, if you wanted to speak a little bit more to that, the importance of the collaborative stance and the ethical stance of it.
Yeah, yes. So I think that's also what we value in systemic theory or systemic therapy, the same thing with that we don't want to be the expert of change, and that I'm very much trained by and inspired by narrative therapy, collaborative therapy, Michael White, Tom Anderson, Harlene Anderson. Those are the theorists or therapists that I learned from a lot. So I use their work and their language when I work with families, when I work with children. So when I thought about research, I thought I can't be the researcher. I can't. It's the same thing as second order cybernetics. You can't separate yourself from the system you're working with. We are always part of the system. So as a researcher, I think that it's, Gregory Bateson already wrote about it. He talked about the participant observer. So as a researcher, I'm a participant observer. I'm an observer, but I'm also a participant of the research, of what we are researching. So when I was looking, for example, in my research about the patterns, repetitive patterns, I was looking to the repetitive patterns that I was, as a therapist, I was part of. And for me, it was very important, and I think that's about ethics, if I make interpretations about what's happening in therapy, how do we learn how we learn? What is the tipping point? What makes the difference? For me, it was very important that it was not my conclusion, but that I could bring my reflections or ideas or findings, but I could present them to the family members themselves and say, this is what I think. What do you think? What do you think that made the difference? What do you think? What was it that we were learning from? And how can you maintain it? Or how can you take that with you in your life? So for me, it was very important that it was not me who made conclusions about other people, but that we gave meaning to the process together. And so I think that's the ethical part of it. So I was, for example, I recorded a lot of the conversations and I made transcripts out of them. And I really liked it that we, together with the family members, we were reading the transcripts loud. And everybody could say, stop. When is something happening? When is something happening that's interesting? And the family members could say, stop. Something is happening that's important and interesting. And I could, as a therapist, say, stop, something is happening that's interesting. And then together we try to find what is the invitation that we feel? How do we sustain patterns? And how can we make a little difference without losing the connection? So together we gave meaning to what was happening in the recordings and in the transcripts. That is collaborative for me and ethical too. Yeah.
Mm. A really beautiful description of that.
I'm
finding myself wanting to know more about the kind of operationalization of that and how you might set that up in practice, how you bring that together. What does that look like, really?
So what I did, and for my doctorate research, it was quite complicated. Right now, and maybe I can tell also a little bit about that, we try to make it more simple. So I'm very happy that my doctoral research was not something I was doing for 5 years and then it was over. Yeah, but I'm together with systemic therapists here in the Netherlands, we try to do similar research in practice. But I made a much more simple model. So therapists can use it even if you're not a researcher supported by the university and you have to write many articles about it. So we made a more easy and simpler version of this. But what I was doing that I was doing and giving the therapy. And for me, it was important that I started to do that. And I know there's also a lot of discussion about this. I try to manualize my way of working. And I like to use the word manual, but as a verb, manualization. So for me, it's important if I manualize my work that it's not frozen or fixed, but that my way of working is changing over time. So when I read a book or when I go to a training or when I hear a colleague of mine telling about his or her work, I get inspired and I change my manual. So it is moving and developing all the time. But I do believe that every professional has some kind of personal manual. So some people don't agree, but I think if I would see, I'm not sure, of course, but if I see 10 of your sessions or of somebody else, that there's some rhythm. Probably there's a way of starting up your first conversation. There's something you do very often in the second session or in the third session. So I believe all of us has some rhythm. And of course, every therapy is different, but I still believe that there's also this rhythm and some kind of things that you bring back or some kind of questions that are important for you and that you always like to ask or very often like to ask. So I thought it's important to write or describe your personalized manual, and I call it manualization, and that was the starting point for me. And the next step is that I really believe that we, and I told it before, that we improvise all the time. So I have an example that I sometimes give because it is for me very, 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 very touching. Some time ago I worked with a family, and it was the first conversation I was having with them. And it was the mother and the father and two girls. And the oldest girl was 12 years old and the youngest was 7. And the youngest girl was crying and screaming very loud from the beginning of the conversation. Really, everybody in the building must have heard it. Huh? Very, very loud. She was screaming and crying. And then the mother said, "This is traumatizing for her. We should stop the therapy. So this is too dangerous." And then the father said, "Well, this is what you always do. So that's why she's doing it. You are rewarding her behavior." And then both parents look to me, "Robert, help us." Huh? And of course, I felt also powerless. I also didn't know what to do immediately. So what I was doing, that I was working with the parents and the older girl of 12, and we made like a constellation with dolls, and I have a red wooden block about all the worries in the family, and I have the green wooden block about the resilience in the family. So I asked her to put the dolls who are close to each other, who are looking to each other, who are far away from each other. Where do you want to put the red block about the worries? Where do you want to put the green block about the resilience? And the girl of 12 put the red block on the table, and she put her little sister on it and her parents next to the red block, and she put the doll about herself very far away. So for the first time, parents realized we came here for the youngest daughter, but the oldest daughter feels very alone and we are too much focused on the problem and too much focused on the youngest. But the little girl was screaming and crying and screaming and crying all the time. And at a certain point, I had to end this conversation. And I really thought that if I would end it like this, this little girl would probably not come back. She would not have a message or that this could help her, because there was no response to her crying and screaming. So I had to think of something. And then I think we improvise. I do not have a strategy about what I can do. But what I did, I took the red block, the red wooden block, and I gave it to the girl. And I said, I think you have to say something to us. That's very, very important. And I think that we, your parents and your sister and I, we don't understand it quite well. And that's the reason why you make so much noise. I think it's about this little red wooden block. And I want to ask you something. Do you want to keep it? Do you want to take it back home and keep it with you? And maybe when you come back next time, next week, and maybe you can tell something or make a drawing about it. I think you have something very important to tell us. And it's about this red wooden block. And the girl stopped crying, and she took the red block and she put it in her sack, and she brought it back home. And her mother told me that she put it on next to her bed the whole week. And when she came back the next time, she made a drawing about it. And I know that this worked very well, and we could start doing family therapy. But I know, of course, that if I have another girl about 7 who's crying and screaming, I could not do the same thing. You never know if it will work or if it doesn't work. So that's, for me, the second thing. We improvise, but I call it coordinated improvisation. It is like what the jazz musician Charles Mingus says, we don't improvise on nothing. You must improvise on something. And jazz musicians improvise, but they also have their standards. So I have my personalized manual, and then I really believe that we are improvising in therapy. But we can improvise if we also take a relational responsibility. So the third step is that we ask feedback all the time. Feedback about how are we collaborating together, and feedback about the developments. What are the developments? And then I do this collaborative research, not about the family members, but with family members. And we try to find out together, how do we learn how we learn? And then I have this research methodology. Shall I tell something about it?
Please.
So what we do is I do the family therapy. And then in every session, I use the feedback lists from Scott Miller, the outcome rating scale and the session rating scale. In my research, I use what we called routine outcome measurements. But right now, in the new research that I'm doing, I'm using the score 15. I think I like to work with it. So mm-hmm. I work with ORS, SRS in every session, and then a couple of times the score 15. And we have a family goals rating list. So we make like on a scale from 0 to 10. Where how did it go in the beginning? How does it go right now? Where do you want to go? And how do we collaborate as a team? So for me, it's also important all the times to evaluate the developments on one hand, and also how are we an effective team? Are we okay together? Do you feel trusted? Do we talk about the things that are important for you? And how can we improve our collaboration to get closer to your goals? That is important. And it's about all the collaboration. So my relationship to the father, to the mother, or to the grandmother, or to the friends, or to other healthcare workers. How are we a collaborative learning team? And how can we collaborate better to improve our collaboration and get closer to the goals that are important for the family members? So that's what we evaluate all the time. And then in every, what I did for my doctoral research, I recorded 2 of the evaluation sessions in every family therapy. And then I chose some what we called critical moments, so moments where something was happening, that you feel the tension or there's more in a dialogue. And then I was making transcripts out of this. I edited my inner dialogue and ask myself the questions I mentioned then before. What do I feel? What am I invited to do? What do I sustain? And how can I make a difference without losing the connection? And then I try to find, it's quite complicated, so if you need more information, please tell me. I use CMM, Coordinated Management of Meaning, to look to the patterns. And I, as a therapist, am a part of the pattern and try to find, are those patterns reactive or reflexive? And we try to see if I could understand what was happening in those patterns within layers of meaning. And I used CMM as a research methodology. And the last question I ask is, how do we learn how we learn? And I use the concept of Gregory Bateson, who talks about third order learning, right? To think about it. And then based on this analyzing of this transcript, I wrote a letter to the family. So it's my thinking based on my analysis, but I write a letter to the family, and then I talk with the family about my interpretations, and I'm curious about their interpretations. And what the most important question is, how can we find interpretations together that help us to go on, to find a way? That is what I did. Mm-hmm. And then I have one time letter about one evaluation, and then later in the process, I'm doing the same thing. Recording it, transcribing it, putting my inner dialogue to it, looking to the patterns that I'm part of within layers of meaning, trying to find out how we learn, write a letter and read it back to the family memory and talk together about how can we find interpretations that can help us to find out how are we learning in therapy. So I hope this was quite a lot.
Oh,
I hope
you can explain it a little bit. Yeah. Yes. I'm trying to take it all in. I went on a journey with you there. Okay. So I was really engrossed because I typically sit in the kind of camp of quite anti-manualized approaches, very much in the kind of social construction criticism of these kind of ways. And there's a quote in your paper, actually, which I wrote down that was quite helpful, that you said that evidence-based practices have been criticized for silencing creativity in therapeutic practice, marginalizing relational inclinations, and restricting therapists' capacity to respond to clients' unique circumstances. And so that's quite a typical critique of manualized evidence-based approaches. But what I'm hearing you describe is something completely different. It's a manualized approach in almost an irreverence or a kind of an act of resistance to manualized approaches by creating something that allows for creativity, for improvisation to really develop within it.
Yeah, and I believe, and I have this because I'm also very much trained within the social constructionist tradition, and I feel connected to that very much. So I had also some difficult discussions about also my kind of research, but I do believe that we also have a relational responsibility to do some research about our work, because I think we work with people who are dependent from us. And I know, and I think we all know, that when we talk about families who have a long history in mental health care, that a lot of people are not very happy about it. And a lot of people have terrible experiences with therapy and with mental health care. So the reason why I think that it's important to do research is that we are in a position of power, and people are dependent on what we are doing. So I really believe that I have to try to find out what does it do what we are doing. I like the quote of Michel Foucault a lot, who says something like, most people know what they do, some people know why they do it, but not many people know what does it do what we do. And I believe that I have to take a relational responsibility to try to find out what does it do what we do, what are we making together. And I think that collaborative research, where not we or the researcher is making interpretations about what's happening, but when we do this collectively, when we do this together, I think that's important, and I think we should do more of it.
I was thinking that was I think my experience as well, is those words like evidence base, manualized, are things that have always sort of made me quite averse to research. Yeah. And I think when I read what you've been doing, I sort of found myself, well, understanding why, but you open my eyes to a completely different way of looking at it, like a different perspective on it. It doesn't have to be what you have always thought it is. And I guess that's the same when you're talking about your practice, and I'm thinking about the families, that they come in with an idea of perhaps of what therapy might be, but you know, from what you've just said, you take them on a completely different journey alongside them in a very transparent way.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you feel now is the time, but the story that came to mind, I really liked reading your case studies, was, and I don't know if you think it fits at this point in the conversation, was about the, it was a mother and daughter in an inpatient. And there was concerns about the mother being able to look after the daughter. Do you know the story I'm talking about? And maybe should I?
It's
I could
probably
try
very
and put
common
it,
in Robert's work, I imagine.
And it was, and I think it was, I think what it was is that the systems around the family were very concerned about the way the mum spoke about the daughter. I think the daughter had some wishes to end her life.
I'm
remembering it in a in a probably quite a vague way, but what I thought was so wonderful, because I guess all the people, the professionals in the network, had this view of the mum, and they were very organized, I suppose, by the risk. And I think what I saw by what you did was very much you took the mother's words of her idea about the daughter as being special and interesting, and she needs to do what she needs to do.
Yeah, I know.
Which, when you know which one I'm talking about, and you could think of that as being so risky, but in the process that you've just described, you found a way to actually use it to initiate change and support for her. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, that was a story that had a lot of impact on me, and it was also risky what we were doing, because the mother had this, the girl never went to school, and her mother had the idea that she was paranormal ideas about she's living between heaven and earth, and she is more like an angel or something like that, and she doesn't fit in this world, and for a long time there was, I don't like the word symbiotic very much, but mother and daughter lived very much together, and it was forced by the judge that she had to take therapy, and for the first time she lived a little bit separated from her mother, and the mother said she can't handle it, but suddenly it went very well with her. She connected with her peers, and she did very well. And then I remember it very well. I talked with the girl to the mother about her improvements, but this mother was not happy with it. She said, "Robert, I'm disappointed in you. Can you not see she's just acting? She's just playing a game." And then after that, the girl fell back in depression, and then the mother said, "I support her in her death wish." And then all the group workers, and I can understand it very well, they said, this mother is dangerous. So what I really believe that if you lose the connection, and that's in my research so important, I really believe, and we know that also from research, that the therapeutic alliance, are we an effective team? That's for me one of the most important questions all the time. That if you lose the connection, you can't do anything. The solidarity to her mother, or the loyalty to her mother, is stronger than to the mental health care workers. So we have to look to a meaning or a narrative that everybody can say yes to. I work a lot with what we call systemic compass. Like also, this also a little bit like a manual, but it's fluid, so it is open for change all the time. But it says it's looking all the time to a yes response. So, for the first step is for the motive. Huh? Are we in for therapy? Huh? What are we worried about? What are our wishes? What are the values that are threatened or under pressure? And is there a good reason to collaborate together? And can everybody say yes to that? That's the first step. And the second step is, how can we create a narrative? How can we make meaning together? And I can't work with interpretations or a hypothesis that I have that I can't share with the family. It doesn't help me. I don't even want to. I'm curious about how can we make meaning together, in a way that everybody involved can say yes to that. And that was important in this case. So we were looking to a story, a narrative, that could, an interpretation that could help us to go on. But we needed an interpretation that everybody could say yes to. So when we said that, when we went with the mother and said, well, maybe your daughter is very, very special, and maybe her when she was protesting against you and telling, I want to be here in the clinic and I don't want to come back home, maybe that was her puberty, because everything goes very fast for her. And so we were looking to an interpretation the mother could say yes to and we could say yes to. And then we said, maybe... And I do not have it completely clear anymore. It was in the text, but maybe this was your puberty and it was important for you. And maybe we can start a new phase in the development where you can live together, but also a little bit separated, like what happens when your children get older. Then the mother could say yes to that, and we could repair our connection. And after that, mother would allow her to stay in contact with us and to follow the therapy. So, but we could only do it when we started to fight against the mother, or when we said this mother is dangerous. Then everybody is confirmed in the same story, in this single story. That so we say, oh, this mother is dangerous, and the mother would say, well, mental health care workers don't understand our situation, and the girl herself was very afraid, I think, because she was very dependent from her mother in her life. So we needed to co-create a story together with the mother, where everybody could say yes to, and then it was possible to make a plan, and then it was possible to collaborate and stay connected with the mother, and also make a small... Well, one of the most beautiful quotes from Gregory Bateson is the small difference that makes a difference. And I often find in my research, if I look together with the family members to the question, what was it that made a difference? What was it that made a change? They do not point to the big interventions in therapy. They almost ever, they say something very, very small. I have a story I sometimes tell about a work I did with a family, a mother, a father, and a boy of 8 years old. And the boy had was very afraid, was very scared, and didn't want to go to school and didn't want to play with friends. And his mother was always with him. And then we externalized fear. We call it Mr. Fear. Huh? And he had to find ways, how do I want to respond to the influence of Mr. Fear on my life? But it was important that the mother took back a step. But mother could only take this step back from her son when she felt more supported by her husband. So we worked with the couple. We helped mother to take a step back, and it was also related to her own family history. And the boy learns to be the boss about the man of fear, and he sang a song, and he worked with a toy from a dinosaur. And then I interviewed not the boy, but I interviewed the dinosaur, and the boy talked as the dinosaur about what was happening in the family. So it was, and I have a small film about it, and I use it a lot when I teach. So it is a therapy I'm quite proud of. But I sometimes when I finish therapy, I ask, well, tell me sometime later, tell me how you are doing, even when it's 7 years later. I probably said something like that. And this kid took it very literally. So 7 years later, he called me and said, Robert, you asked me to tell you how it was going 7 years later. So I invited him, and he was long. And I asked, how are you doing? And he went very well, and his family was also doing very well. And then I asked, what do you remember from therapy? What was it that made a change? And then this boy said, it was the orange ball. And I was confused. I thought, he's confusing me with another therapist. But then I remembered that in the beginning, when we were doing family therapy, in the last 10 minutes, we were playing soccer with an orange ball. And he was trying to score and against me. And of course, he did. And he said, I didn't want to go to you. I was very afraid. But because of this game with this orange ball, I started to like you. And I started to like to come to therapy. And without this ball, it would not have worked. You would not have succeeded. And often when I ask the question, what was it that made a difference? Family members point at this small, playful differences. So I am always open and always curious about those small differences that makes a difference. So That's what I'm looking for when I work with feminists. And that's what I'm looking for when I do research with them about how can we make meaning together and how can we find something small that makes a difference.
It's a really lovely story. Thank you for sharing that, because it's really brought it to life. And I'm thinking about in training institutes, I don't know what it's like in your context, but when we do our kind of masters, we have to do a viva. And yeah. a viva is looking back at those kind of critical moments or moments that you think might have changed. And I'm wondering how different, you know, hearing you talk of how different my understanding of what would be a critical moment to what a family might say. And I've never had the opportunity to do that alongside a family. I'm really fascinated by the power of that, what might come of that in terms of generative stuff of then me understanding the process of therapy or how I could be useful in those sessions and those spaces with families. It's such an amazing learning tool.
Have you got a question?
I was going to bring back to the compass, because I don't want us to miss that. And thanks for bringing that in. And you've kind of spoken a bit about the process of it. About the kind of the stages, four stages is from what I understand of the motive, the creating a collaborative shared narrative, then get into a place of goals,
and finally
feedback. Could you tell us a little bit more about that as a model in itself? I know you've kind of began to speak about it, but in terms of what you've noticed from working in that way and using the compass.
So it is based, and I think for me it's important to say, it's based on the work of Jan Olthof, also a Dutch family therapist. And we, together with colleagues from the Lawrence House here, with Veronique Limpus, Marika Reume, developed this. And again, it is not fixed. Eh? It is, Mark White always talked about maps, and I like it. It is a way to orient yourself. It's not step one, step two, step three. It's not meant that way. But I talked about improvisation before and jazz music, and I think that a good jazz musician knows the standards. Eh? So there's a structure you can fall back to or you can refer to when you got lost, but if you have the structure, you can let it go and you can improvise. And I think a bit similar about family therapy, that I improvise, but when I got lost, I have something to orient myself or to use to find direction again. So that's how I use it. And we call it a compass, because it helps us to orient in messy processes. So step one is finding a yes from everybody about the motive. So we ask, for example, we start with problem-free talk. So every family is much more than the problem alone or than the problem story. So for me, when I talk for the first time with family members, I often say, I know you are. There are worries, and worries are the reason that you're here. But I know you are much more than the worries alone. And for me, it's important when I get to know you to see you not only as the problem or the worry. So can you please give me the opportunity to get to know you in also different ways? So can you tell me something you are proud of, or if you think about a very happy memory with this family, what pops up? Or can you introduce the one who's sitting next to you, and can you think about something you like to do together with that person who is sitting next to you? So that's always my start, my start. And then I like to talk about worries. We've learned this from Professor Peter Rober from Belgium. And don't ask what's the problem, because then it's linear, and then it's about we individualize very easy. So you have a problem, or a father says, well, my son is lazy, he doesn't go to school. And then the son says, well, my father is too rigid and he doesn't understand me. So when you ask about the problem, people are pointing, and it becomes individualized or linear. So we talk about worries, because when we ask about worries, people say something about themselves. The father says, I'm worried about my son. If he doesn't go to school, it's a very complicated society we live in. I never had the support from my father. I try to support him, but he doesn't listen. So he tells something about himself, and it's about a concern. It's about a relation. So I like to talk about worries and not about problems. And of course, we ask about wishes, and we ask it in a very circular way. So is it goes better, or if we are half a year from now, what are you hoping you can tell us? And if the father says, well, then my son go back to school, I make it circular. I ask, okay, if he goes back to school, what will happen with you? Oh, I will be relieved. Okay, if you are relieved, does that influence the way you are a father for your son? Oh, yes, I think I would be a completely different father. I would ask him to go fishing. We used to do that. Well, if you are relieved and ask him to go fishing, do you think that would help him to go back to school or would make it more difficult to go back to school? So I try to make circles out of that all the time. And then I ask about values. I learned that from Michael White. I really, one of the most beautiful sentences in our work, I think, is from Michael White. It's about pain is a testimony to something that is precious, and people are afraid that something precious got lost. So pain is not the problem. Pain is resistance. Pain is protest. So what are you protesting against? And so I try to talk about that. And then we have the first yes, and I want a yes from everybody, even if people disagree about what is the cause and what should happen. But I need a yes from everybody about something is happening that we don't want, or something is happening in our family that goes against our values. That's the first yes. And if people can say yes, we can go to the next step, and it's co-creating a narrative. What is a good reason why you are doing what you do? And sometimes we can look to through different lenses from systemic perspectives. We can look to the family development. We can look to the family structure, thinking about Mnuchin. We can look to the repetitive patterns or to the communication about content or process. We can look to affection. We can look to the narratives. Are there small narratives or richer narratives? I can externalize if I ask if people can say, yes, something is happening. It goes against our values. I can say, okay, can you give it a name? How can we call it? Or can you draw it? So then the problem is externalized, and I can ask what's the influence of the externalized problem on the father, on the mother, on the boy, on the sister. And the father says, oh, I'm irritated. And the mother says, I'm worried. And sometimes the problem is in between the parents, and they got fights about what to do. And it's also has influence on the sister who goes back to her room and doesn't go to the living room anymore. So I can say, is that's what's happening? Or is the externalized problem separating you? And then I look for, again, I look for a yes response. Is that why we're here? Can we try to become an effective team and collaborate in that way that the externalized problem loses its influence on you as a family? And again, I'm looking for the yes response. So for the narrative we are making, we can only work with, I said it before, we can only work with the narrative or the stories that everybody agrees on. So I look for the yes response. And after that, we make a plan. We call it collaborative helping plan. It's based on the work of Bill Metzen. And then it starts again with values. What's the vision of the family? What is important? What are they afraid of? What is precious, or what are the values in the pressure? So that's the first step, and then we look to what is blocking that, or what is standing in the way to live in harmony with those families, with those values. Sorry, and then we look to support what helps you to live in harmony with your values, and then we make a plan. And for me, it's very important. If I make a plan that we have goals for everybody. So I worked in child psychiatry, and mm-hmm. often only the child had goals. So I always find it very dishonest, or because often children don't ask for therapy themselves. So we make goals for everybody, also the therapists and also the mental health care workers. So everybody has goals. What are we going to do to break the circle, to break the pattern? And if everybody can say yes, that's the last thing, sorry. Mm. If everybody can say yes to the plan, then we start FITS, then we start with feedback-informed work. So we start working together, and we ask all the time about how are we collaborating together, what are the developments, how can we collaborate better to improve and get closer to the goals, and what can we learn from that. So that's all.
That's all. that feels, hearing you talk and talk us through that feels like such a gift, really. And you say that's all, like that is it feels like a year's worth of course content that people can really go and develop. And I mean, that the Madsen's collaborative maps is something that I've recently really started using kind of consistently in my work. I find it so helpful in consultations with groups or in therapy with families. I'm interested in how you said that you have goals for different members of a network. And would you do in terms of those collaborative maps, would you do a collective one or is it individualized separate ones for people that you then bring together?
We make a collective plan. So if everybody can, for example, when there is violence in a family or when I really believe that's also for me, if we talk about ethics, also systemically very important for me, that I really believe that if there are very serious problems, that we should never make an individual alone responsible for the cause or the solution. So I believe in collective change. We have to work together. So I like when we work with very serious or severe cases, I like to ask or to invite what we call a collaborative learning community. So who can help? So sometimes the neighbors or the policemen in the neighborhoods or a good friend of the son or the parents of the friend of the son. So we create a collaborative learning community that works together. And we ask them, do you want to be committed? Do you want to be helpful? We can't do it alone. Nobody can do it alone. It's too much. It's too serious. But together we can do it. And then I like to make goals for everybody. So what are the neighbors? What is the father? What is the mother? What are the grandparents? What are the children? What are the healthcare workers or the therapists? How can everybody who is involved commits to something? This is my task. This is what I'm going to do. And sometimes when we evaluate the process, it is the mental health care workers that had, it was too busy. I did not have time to do it. Huh? So it makes it more equal, I think, to that everybody in the collaborative learning community is taking his or her responsibility to this is my job. This is what I can do. Well, this is my job. This is what I can do. This is my job. This is what I can do. So everybody takes a responsibility. And the collaborative helping map of Bill Madsen is in a way very easy, but it's brilliant because it's so clear. And I like when we make the plan, the fourth step, then it's, I also always ask, how can we collaborate in that way that we can, we avoid the externalized problems or the things that makes it more difficult and use the supports in order to live in harmony with the values or the vision of the family. So I like that very much. I think it's very practical and easy to use. Mm-hmm. So we make one plan for everybody. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Julie, I don't know if we've lost your question when we interrupted. Did we move on from what you wanted to say?
I think so, but well, not moved on. I think in some ways you've kind of answered it because my question was really about creating a culture for feedback and how you do that. But I think you explaining the process is kind of showing us that in so many ways. So I think it was answered.
Maybe it is. Can I say one thing about it? Because I think it's a very important question because a lot of people ask for feedback. But feedback alone is not enough. When I go to a restaurant and they ask me for feedback and I don't know what will happen with that feedback, I don't want to give it. So it's very easy to ask for feedback. I know when I studied in the UK that even when I went to the toilet and I came out of it in the airport, I can push on buttons, but how clean was it? So you can give feedback about everything. But I think what I like about the idea of the culture of feedback that it is something you do together. So asking for feedback is one thing, but the more important is what do we decide to do differently because of the feedback? That's so important. How do we, because you can ask for feedback. Sometimes when you're polite, you can ask for feedback and they say, okay. But the most important thing is, how do we make a change? How do we change our approach or our way of working, our way of collaborating, to talk a little bit about more about this instead of that, because of the feedback? And that's the most important thing. Therefore, I think creating a culture of feedback is very, very important.
Yeah, and I guess what I've also heard from what you've said, I know it's something that I've been thinking about recently is how honest are people, how do you even create a space where people can give you the meaningful feedback, really, as well, and feedback that's authentic and true from them. And I think what I've got from today is actually all the steps that you need to do to lay the foundations to create that feedback.
Yeah.
In the first place, there's actually a lot of work before you even ask the question.
Yeah. Mm.
And that intentionality of it that you're saying, of what you do with feedback, because in the paper you lay it out very usefully about feedback being classified as positive and negative in terms of the kind of the effect on a system, not the content itself. So it's a bit of an inverted idea, right? And inviting positive feedback in terms of something that might change something, whether the content could then be quite negative. It could be a criticism of what's happened.
Yeah. But
if there's a concept that's invited in order to make improvements or to make changes or to drive a therapeutic session in a certain direction that's useful, then it creates a kind of fertile ground, I'm understanding, for that feedback to be encouraged.
I think that's a very systemic idea. Huh? So if we think about concepts from Maturana and Varela about autopoiesis, about self-organization, we know that an organization can learn from its mistakes when there are feedback loops all the time. So every living organism in medium or in a bigger context can survive if it is stable enough. So you need negative feedback loops in order to keep homeostasis or to stay connected or to maintain certain patterns. But a living system also has to change or learn or adapt or change its structure in relationship to the environment. And that's on the basis of positive feedback loops. So if a community organizes itself based on feedback loops, it can become self-organizing. So it stays alive, and maybe also a bit, Julie, what you said about authenticity, or I think that's very important too. I believe that I cannot only invite people. That's my responsibility, but it's their responsibility how to say something about it. I can't control that, but this culture of feedback is important, because I remember, it's also a small story about a girl who was in the spectrum, had a diagnosis of autism, and she didn't want to go to school and she didn't want to talk with therapists. So I talked with her mother and the teacher on the before her bedroom. So her bedroom door was closed and I was sitting in the hallway before her bedroom, and we were talking about how can we collaborate together, how can we help her, how can we understand what is happening. And then behind her door she said, no, that's not right, you're wrong. And after a couple of times she was part of the conversation. She came out of the bedroom because she wanted to tell her story as well. So she was part of the conversation. And then I was so curious about her. I wanted to invite her to join the research that I was doing. And so I gave her those lists, the outcome rating scale list and the session rating scale list. And I asked her, can you please, because there are these skills with 10 centimeters. So I asked her, can you give a cross about how do you collaborate with me? Do we talk about the things that are important for you? What do you think about my approach? How can we do things different? And then she looked the other way. She didn't want to look to the paper. And she put, with her pencil, she put it like that. And then I started to measure it very seriously. She said, oh, it's a little bit better than last time. And then she started laughing as she fell out of the couch. But the funny thing is that, of course, the numbers say nothing. The numbers are not, well, Rolf Sundet from Norway calls it the conversational tools. The numbers have no meaning. They have meaning when we start talking about it. So what I was, even when she was filling in without looking to the other direction, I invited her in a culture of feedback. I tried to learn from her, what do you need from me so I can become a good therapist for you? I want to learn from you what you need from me. And you're the only one who can tell it. And I can give my hand, but it's up to you if you can take it or not. So we find a way of discussing about our therapeutic relationship, even when the numbers didn't mean much because she just put it there.
The word that comes to mind, which I think you've used in this conversation, but I've also seen in your writing, is the trustworthiness and the importance of that and these ways of creating it.
Yeah, that's important. I sometimes when we talk about research, they like to think about how is something. They like to look for universal truth, and I don't believe in that. I like to talk about local trustworthy. Eh? So how are we trustworthy in this situation with this family, with this therapist? That is important for me when I think about research. It's not about finding or making conclusions that we can generalize or that we can repeat over and over again. I want to be trustworthy in this situation. Yeah.
Robert, I'm interested in you reflecting on your own processes since you've started working in this way and being very more intentional in this kind of approach. What have you noticed in yourself as a therapist?
Yeah, that's a very good one. Yeah, I one of the things is that in the beginning. In the beginning, I thought about I'm doing therapy, I'm doing family therapy, and I do research. I thought of it as two separate practices. But one of the things that I've learned is that sometimes the conversations we were having that were about the collaborative research were much more therapeutical than the original therapy. And all the time I was, there was, it's also in one of my texts, a case we were very worried about. It was a girl of 12 who was self-harming very, very, very much and cutting very deep in her skin. And she was also driving with her bicycle next to the railway. And we were very scared about her and the school didn't want to have her anymore. And we had, and there was also, again, there was something very small happening that she liked coming to therapy, and sometimes it went very well. We could see it in the graphs, and then suddenly it goes completely down. So it was, and then suddenly the parents said to me, "Robert, you're nice, and we can see you have a good relationship with us and with our daughter, but this is not enough. It's not helping." And suddenly I had this strange sensation. I had a feeling as if it was very cold, and I could not find out why, but I felt coldness. I felt, and I learned what I've learned by doing this research is to sometimes to make that public, to say something about it. So maybe this sounds strange, but I feel cold. And then the mother suddenly was surprised by it and said, "Cold is completely the right word. I feel cold." And she looked to her husband and she said, "I'm too much alone in this. You run away. You come back too late from work. I'm too much alone in this. I can't do this alone. I need you." And she also looked to her daughter and she said, "Well, if we are the best parents and this is the best therapist, we can do nothing if you don't want to be helped. You have to join us. We are worried and something must happen." It came right out of her heart. And the word cold stays with her. And the silly thing was that she decided the next week to go with her best friends to Spain. She wanted to go to the sun. And she left her daughter and her husband alone. And the husband was very, said, "Oh, what can I do?" And in the beginning, it went quite well. But then again, the girl was self-harming and didn't go to school. And then the father decided not to call his wife or mother, but he called me and said, "Robert, can we make an appointment? I want to have a conversation with my daughter, with Jenny," not her real name. "And can I do that together with you?" And of course, I made time for it. And the father came in the therapy room with Jenny, with her daughter, and didn't even look to me. He looked directly to Jenny and said, I want to make a bet. I want you to go back to school. And if you go back to school for 1 month, I give you a training suit of Ajax. That's a soccer team you yes. know. And I don't know that much about soccer, but to be honest. But the girl, her eyes fell out of her head, because what was the case? She was a big fan of Ajax, and her father was a big fan for Feyenoord from Rotterdam. Ajax is from Amsterdam. Uh-huh. And for the father, like, Ajax was like the devil or something. It was the most evil thing on earth. Eh? So it was that serious. So for her, that her father would make a bet and would buy her a training suit from this soccer team from Amsterdam, was, she couldn't believe it. Really? Are you going to do it? And the stupid thing is, she went to school the whole month. And then of course the mother came back from Spain, and of course it was still not, and we had some difficult times, but never it went that deep or that bad. And then I tried to find out together with the family, what was it? What made the difference? Because I thought, how can this was such a, we were so worried about her. We were thinking about, she has to go to an inpatient department. She can't go back to the ordinary school. She has to go to a special school. So we really thought, how can this, something stupid like a bet about a soccer team make the difference that matters? And then it's nice to do this collaborative research to try to find it out together. Because the mother said, for me, this word cult really made a difference. Hmm. You said something that I felt and I didn't have words for it. And I decided to do something that nobody could expect from me. I went to Spain. And then father said, I also did something that nobody expected me. Because if it was difficult with Jenny, our daughter, I would always go to you, yeah, to my wife. And I would always ask you to interfere. And this time I did something myself. And then Jenny, the daughter, said, and you did not copy what mama was doing, we did something that was honest, that was you. So that I was so surprised, I wanted to see, do you really go to, so everybody did something different. So and that's what systemic therapy is about, I think. It's about escaping, about doing the unexpected, to escape from the repetitive questions, to step into the unknown. And sometimes it's a very small thing that can help to do this, to make this difference. So what I learned from it, if you ask about me, is also to bring in my own inner dialogue, to say something about what I feel, and to trust sometimes what I feel. So these questions, based on the work of Tom Anderson and also described by Peter Rober, what am I invited for? What do I sustain? How can I make a difference without losing connection? For me, those three questions are very important. I ask them myself all the time, and I try to trust my own feelings and the invitation that I feel. And the funny thing is, when I had this family was in my research, and I, the last thing I did in my thesis, in my doctoral thesis, is that I didn't want to talk myself, so I asked colleagues and family members to have as a focus group talk together. I wrote a letter about my research and I read it to them, and then I asked them to talk about it, and I didn't want to interfere myself. And this girl, this Jenny, was part of that group. So she and then she said something about one of the most important things is that you have a therapist that is warm and that can come close to you and that you really feel understand by. And I maybe this sounds simple, but I think it is important that our clients or the family members that ask for help, they do not only meet a therapist, a professional, but they meet you as a person. And I really believe that it is important for us that we work with our personal self also as a professional, and that we allow people to get to know you a little bit. That's also what I learned from this research.
Thank you for sharing that again, Robert. The word human comes really kind of felt this human connection, and yeah. In a very human way. being genuinely interested in how can I help you? You know, how is this going, rather than this kind of professional clinical position of this is what I do. And if it works for you, then great. If it doesn't work for you, then I guess it's locating the problem in people again, right?
Yeah, it's
a very human approach. And I know we're coming to the end of time, Robert, but I'm also mindful that you did say that you'd be interested, and it might be for another conversation, and please say if it is, about kind of future thinking around like post-humanism, new materialism, and the actor network theory. I don't quite understand it. So I don't know if there is something you might want to make connections for, or if you want to think for another day.
I think what I am writing about and reading about and thinking about a lot right now is, well, also how is systemic theory evolving and fitting in the time where we live right now, with a climate crisis and with the big influence of technology. And I sometimes think, and I talk also with other therapists or systemic theorists about this, if we go back to Gregory Bateson, he always talked about the three ecologies. So it's the minds, it's the social, and it's the living environments. And I sometimes think that we also, as family therapists, we have knowledge about the mind, we have knowledge about the social, but to really include the living environments, I think there's a I think we can do much more about that. We can develop that more. I don't have the author right now, but somebody said the living environment is our second body. We have our body, but the world we live in is our second body, and we neglect it sometimes. So what I really believe that can be also an inspiration for our work to make it contemporary is to, well, read the work of Donna Haraway, who talks about cyborgs, to read the work of Bruno Latour, who talks about actor networks. So he talks about multi-actor networks. And then the system is not only the human system, but the system is what is emerging in all the actors in the network. And that's also the trees in the garden, and the technology, and the table where I'm working on, or the computer that make it possible for us to have this conversation. What is emerging is not only the result of human actors, but it's what's happening as a result of the response abilities of all those actors, and there are human actors, but there are also non-human actors. And I think that in contemporary philosophy, we say the anthroposophy, where the human is the center of the world. Well, that has become a big problem. So we have to decenter ourselves as humans, and not to see ourselves as above technology or nature, but as part of technology and nature. So I sometimes think, and as I think we have to talk much more about it to really include, how can we work with that idea also in therapy? But I think to think about systems, not only with human actors, but also non-human actors, is very important. There's maybe one small example in the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. They do research about neighborhoods where there's a lot of poverty. And they see that when there are a lot of kids with behavioral problems, they see a difference when they have, they call it the green gorillas. They have, when they make a living environment more green, with so more trees, more flowers, more gardens, and it really has an effect on how people behave, or how people feel connected with the area where they live. And I sometimes think this kind of interventions or ways of workers, we should include them in our therapy. So we should not only talk about how do we communicate with each other, but also how do we co-create, eco-resistance? How do we co-create multi-actor networks that make the world more comfortable, or more livable, or more, I don't know the word. do you know what I understand?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so,
and I think this is just starting. I think this, I really hope that this is a start of a conversation that we can have as systemic practitioners. Yeah.
But Robert, I've been waiting for a point in the conversation, and I'm to use this. Would you classify these things in terms of, does it get woven in some way with being a systemic nomad? Because I love that in your article, Murmurations.
Yeah.
I think there's something of becoming a systemic nomad as part of some of these things that you've spoken about, which I think is a good way of looking at it. I hope people go and look it up and find it and read it.
I think that is also inspired by the work of the French philosopher Deleuze and Rosie Bradotti and nomads. And I also in my training, in my doctoral training, I had the honor to have some discussions with John Schotter about also my work, and it was fascinating to talk with him. And I think his work is still not understood well or something, or there's so much to learn from it. I think he was before his time, and I remember one of the conversations we were talking about the French philosopher Deleuze, and we were talking about we are always in the process of becoming, and that's what the nomad is doing. We're always in the processes of becoming, but we also need a temporary result in the process of becoming. So sometimes we need to stand still and orient ourselves. And where are we? What is the narrative that we can make in this process of becoming? So this idea of a temporary result in the process of becoming is something that I like to think of. Also, when I refer to manuals we talked about, and when I talk about manualization, it's not something fixed. I never hope that people will do exactly the same thing as what I found. I hope that people are inspired by it and make it a little bit different, and that they tell me something that inspires me and that helps me to make my manual a little bit of difference. So we are working with temporary results in the process of becoming, but being in the process of becoming and always believing that it will evolve and it goes on and it will change over and over again, that's very important. And also our systemic ideas, also our systemic theory. I think we live in a very complicated time, and I think systemic theory is a response, and I think it's necessary to answer about what's happening in the world right now. Maybe this is sounds a little bit too big, but I really hope to have discussions with people who also think this way, and how can we renew our way of thinking and make it fitting within the world where we live right now.
Thank you, Robert. It'd be wonderful to have you back to carry on that conversation.
Okay, I would like to do that. Yeah, I really do. Yeah.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us. It was a fantastic conversation.
Thank you. I really liked it myself, and I really hope we can continue it someday. Yeah,
absolutely.
Indeed. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Have a good week. Take care. Bye bye.